This week, we speak to our new associate producer, James Walpole.
Then, Multi-Gateway. And then later, we interview Sam Patterson of Open Bazaar. I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
Today, we're introducing James Walpole. James, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Eric. It's great.
Why don't you talk a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm 18 years old, and I'm working at one of the most innovative companies on the planet with the most interesting and competent people I've ever met.
You're working at Disney?
Apple?
Well, actually, working in BitPay, and we're really making progress, and really actually seeing in real terms what decentralization looks like. And as we say here, we like to decentralize all the things. And being a part of this podcast with these gentlemen, these fine gentlemen, is a great experience of that.
Awesome. As a follow-up to that, you've chosen not to go through the traditional route of going to a four-year university or college. You are using a different program called Praxis. Can you give us a little bit of what led your decision-making and a little bit on Praxis and what they do?
Absolutely. So I've always been very interested in ideas, and particularly ideas around things like decentralization and individual freedom. And seeing the culture of colleges and seeing the general idea that they're meant to be institutions of learning, but oftentimes the culture there is very conformist, very dedicated to letting the users, letting the students kind of give up control of your education to third parties, if we're going to use that term, to outside authorities, really turned me off to the idea of college. And really, when I discovered Praxis, which is really a 10-month program for entrepreneurial people who really want to take control of their education and direct it themselves, I leap for it. And it's been one of the best decisions of my life, actually, along with working here at BitPay. And discovering this way of learning and taking control of my education has really, I think, spilled over into other areas of my life and my interests, and decentralization is one of those.
What would be your advice to other individuals who may not have the insight or the opportunity to have the information that you have access to?
I would say that's a difficult question. Obviously, like I said, I'm 18 years old. I can't speak for everyone. And what works best for every person is going to be different. That's probably the insight that's most important that I've gained, I guess. But I would say that finding a way to make your learning, your education, and your personal development the most self-interested thing, to make it a matter of pure enjoyment and pure freedom or direct control over your learning, is one of the most important things. That can really change your life and really open up new ways of thinking to you.
Absolutely. So one of the things, I mean, I too eschewed the average, you know, college experience. I was just like, I don't know why I would want to go to college, quite frankly. One of the things I thought about was, or rather didn't think about, was what was it that I wanted to do in the future? Rather, I was thinking about what was it that I wanted to do right now. Later on in life, I realized that this sort of embodied what it meant to be truly free, right? You start to think about what are the actions that you want to endeavor to do right now, and you do those things. There can be consequences. There can be rules and laws that tell you you're not allowed to do something. And there can be, in the education system, there can be systems that say you must study these things. To some degree, I think that there's a lot of merit to saying, you know, in order for you to have a bright future, you must study and understand these concepts. One of the things that I found, however, was if I pursued the things that I was most interested in, then I would become competent in them and subsequently able to take my skills and apply them in a way that could be contributing to a commercial society. What was your experience as you moved into this?
I would say, and really in response to that, I think you're very right, that there's not really a conflict between choosing what you want to do and living your life in your own way and a good future. Because really our futures or our lives are a sum of our individual actions. So what drove me to this decision for myself was not only seeing what I did not like in college, But seeing what I liked in the people I respect, in the values I hold, and the fulfillment of the ideas I value, seeing this and realizing that the only way to achieve those things was to achieve it through the individual actions, through the small steps, and not to wait for it to happen to me. One of the worst things you can do is to wait for things to happen to you in life. So doing praxis, joining praxis, and choosing not to go to college was one of those things, one of those decisions which I sort of found myself in with my back to the wall in terms of time and in terms of the importance of the decision. So I think that gave me a lot of moral resolution to do it, and I'm very glad I did.
Excellent. Well, we're very much looking forward to your contributions to the show.
Absolutely. And I actually have one other thing I wanted to say on that, Eric, and that is, as someone, I went through the traditional four-year university experience, and I gained a little bit out of it, not as much as I was hoping, but I also think that's dependent on the person, personality type, school. There's so many different variables there. But I admire you and what you're doing very much so. I've told you this personally, and had the chance to work with you for the past few months, and it seems like you're gonna turn into something great, and you kind of already are, and that's awesome. And the other thing that I really love of what you spoke on is that you can't wait for it to happen to you. And I, you know, myself, I was stuck in Detroit in a city where, you know, there is job. Don't get me wrong, there's jobs there, but it's not the greatest land of opportunity. And I was really fortunate to get into these decentralized technologies years ago, and something did great happen to me. But I'm so the exception here. And you know, the people that really are pursuing what they enjoy and making sure that, you know, they know as much about that as possible, they're the ones that are going to have great opportunities coming to them because they care and they put forth that much effort toward it. And when I see, you know, when I see people like yourself, like Eric, like Chaz, our producer here, who really, you know, have a passion for what they're doing, it matters. You know, anyone who's had a job where they're working with people that don't have that passion, it is a job. It's going to work, and they hate it, and, you know, they go to work, and they get yelled at by their boss, and they end up just sad. Whereas every day I come in here, I'm hanging out with friends that we pretty much, we may have minor disagreements, but we all pretty much are on the same page with things. And that's the first time in my life that I've been given this opportunity as well. And it's awesome, and it's the best feeling in the world when you have people that, you know, you're all working toward the same or similar goals, and you're really, you know, towards something awesome there. And, you know, when we were off air, we were speaking on what I want to bring up next, and Eric was against it. And I think that's cool that we're going to talk about this, because I think that's important. And he may not even not want to talk about this in depth, but I do. And it was about Bitcoin Black Friday, which I'm going to plug because it's something where I've had a lot to do with. So BitcoinBlackFriday.com. That's it. That's all I want to talk about that, because that's a big issue this week. But there's a supplement to it this year called Giving Tuesday, which is focused around charities. There's one charity that means a lot to me, and it's the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And there's additional one that I would like to plug called the Internet Archive, archive.org. And the other is EFF.org. First and foremost, EFF. I think everyone at this table is a fan of this. I know Eric is. And what they do is they've silently and publicly spent tons of donation dollars to help fight for the freedom that we all enjoy. When you download this podcast, to when we upload it, to when we share the torrent, there's so much transfer of information that's happening, and it's so valuable and important that the charities and the folks that are involved with keeping it free need to be supported. And there's been a lot of hype and talk about net neutrality here, lately, I should say. And it is important. But the EFF are the ones that have been fighting this battle for the past, you know, what, 20 years? And they've done it when it wasn't a hot topic, when there weren't people talking about it all the time, and when it wasn't worth clicks on Google. You know, and it's important to really support them. So I would say on Giving Tuesday, which is next Tuesday, and every other day, if you're going to donate, you know, $5 sent to a charity, and if you value the freedom of the Internet, I would recommend you donate to them. We don't want to tell you how to spend your money, but that's how I'm spending some of mine on Giving Tuesday. And the thing I would like to do is, you know, this is Thanksgiving, so we all talk about what we're thankful for. And I'm thankful that I have this opportunity to be here in Atlanta with coworkers that are on the same page as myself. I'm thankful that the Internet exists, so it gives me the freedom that I had to teach myself important skills, knowledge, information about things I care about that weren't a part of school, because that's where my best opportunities have came, I've noticed, personally in my life. And as we go around the table, I think that's something cool we could do right now. It's not necessarily what you're thankful for, but if you want, you can obviously speak on that. But what are you enjoying this season? What do you want to do, and what do you want to do, and I guess what's coming up? And Eric, I'm going to throw this to you.
Yeah, so let me be clear. I am very much in support of the EFF and the Internet Archive. What I am slightly concerned with is this support of commercialism and support of centralized entities that have not formed themselves within the decentralized economy. What I would like to support, maybe even ideally this year, but I don't think that the things are sufficiently advanced enough, next year or the year after, what I want, my goal, is for us to be able to go around the table and talk about what merchants are only available on OpenBazaar, are only available on BitMarkets, are only available via these decentralized mechanisms that completely disintermediate any sort of third-party transaction method. That's what I'm looking for. And those are the types of entities, ultimately, that I'm going to be giving towards as not only this year and the next year, and as I accrue more and more capital. I think there's an interesting discussion right now about Tipping Tuesday versus Giving Tuesday. They're both sort of on the same day. Tipping Tuesday, to me, is about finding a peer and tipping them for a commentary or for some contribution that they've made in general to either the open source community or the overall intellectual powerhouse, whatever that may be. Giving Tuesday, to me, I'm a little worried about. And there's a few interesting parties here that stand out to me. EFF and Internet Archive obviously are shining examples of centralized entities that I would support because their overall mission is one of providing freedom and access to information.
I think also when you classify them as centralized entities, the reason that I think they are centralized entities is because they are from an era where decentralized entities weren't possible. And I think that it's important to differentiate that. And when I love the point that you made when you said maybe not this year, because it's not ready there. It's not ready yet. And mm-hmm. and you know, it's something where we're working toward that, and we're spreading the word, and we're doing that. And that's why I think that any charities that have done it for that long, or you know, especially with archive.org, there's so much information there that's free to the public, and that's how information should be. It's free.
Absolutely. Information deserves to be free.
Yes.
Unless it's a finite resource, in which case there should be a market for disseminating it. The other interesting thing that you mentioned there is decentralized applications, and we'll talk about a little bit about this later. Decentralized applications are sort of a new concept that are only truly enabled as a result of the existence of the blockchain. We have the ability to establish distributed consensus. But similarly, this is why there's such a friction point right now between governments and the people, right? The reason governments exist the way they do today is because it was not possible for individuals to have complete and true freedom by themselves without some sort of and simultaneously have some sort of mechanism for governance without having some method of sending a representative, right? That was the solution to the problem. We had, you know, hundreds of millions of square miles of territory where we needed to coordinate between people to agree upon laws of governance. And the solution that we came upon for governance was one of centralized solutions, right? We agreed to send to vote democratically into power representatives who would go and travel the 2 or 3 days necessary to travel to Washington, D.C., to represent our individual votes, right? We didn't have the internet back then. We barely had a postal system. We didn't even have a postal system, quite frankly, in the beginnings of that, right? Mm-hmm. Only over time were we able to develop more and more efficient methods of communicating and disseminating, as you said, information. And I think this is the most critical part of things. Now that we have the internet, we have for the first time, just like as Project Gutenberg massively, orders of magnitude, increase the bandwidth of communication available to the average member of the population, we have the internet now. And as a result, the internet has absolutely, 100, 1,000, a million times increased the bandwidth of communication and subsequently information that's available to us. So as we talk about like Giving Tuesday and, Tipping Tuesday, I do want to encourage people to think about, who is it that you're giving to? Is it a centralized entity, or is it someone who is encouraging the development of technology that will allow us to empower ourselves in 10 or 20 or 50 more years?
Yeah.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Internet Archive, are perhaps the two most important entities that exist today, and I hope that many more will exist in the future that you can donate to. So I'd encourage you to do that.
Absolutely. And as a supplement to that, before we get to this sounds corny, but the what are you thankful for, James? when we're talking about the Project Gutenberg, that actually was one of the first internet services. I was doing some research on it, and in 1971, this became someone's pet project where they wanted to digitize, I think it was the 10,000 most important works in human history, to make sure that they're preserved forever. And this is in 1971, before, most folks, almost everyone, unless you're really were at a university or a government agency, they didn't know about an internet. They had no idea. So, there was this idea that information was free in some degree back then. And I think that, it's all about redefining how you view it. And with that being said, one of the things that I would love is, personally, I would love if Gutenberg.org accepted Bitcoin. They're someone that I think that is worthy of me donating funds to. And as soon as they open up that avenue and they start supporting decentralized services, I'm going to support them financially. I think that's important. And I feel that way about a lot. And the point that you made that I think we should all hammer home is think and do research before you give to anyone. There are so many charities out there, and I'm not going to name names here, but you'll hear about them. Well, they'll be trying to cure something, and 90% will not go toward research. It'll go toward overhead costs, which really you can put a lot under that category. Make sure that whatever you're doing when you make a donation, and you now have, and by say you, the audience now has the ability to research these companies.
It's really interesting. What Bitcoin offers is the ability to completely track 100% exactly where the money is going.
Mm-hmm.
Sean's Outpost is a great example of this. Just recently they had a fantastic discussion about, what are their expenses and, where are they going. Jason King is doing a fantastic job over there, by the way. It's really interesting. I think next year when this same conversation comes up, we'll maybe have a few more opportunities to donate to companies where we can have full transparency and see exactly where our donations are going. Did my donation go towards the salary of $110,000 a year, fund manager or community manager? Or did it go towards actually providing the meals, like Sean's Outpost does, that homeless individuals are able to be paid for, to be able to consume, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's ultimately why I'm very interested in the blockchain technology, is this opportunity for us to finally unseat these powers that, are just asking for money and simply provide a paper report, which can be padded, which can be cheated, which can be lied upon, and rather provide a fundamentally, truly accountable record of exactly where the money is going and what it's being used for.
Absolutely, and that's absolutely why Bitcoin and decentralized networks and technologies and platforms, whatever word you want to enter in there, are extremely important. And we're going to go to you, James. What are you thinking about lately as far as what you're thankful for?
Yeah, I would say that really the thing I'm really thankful for in terms of trends and developments as I see them is the fact that now the decentralizers are kind of the heroes of culture. If you look at things, if you look at the way in which decentralized technologies, even on a large scale, have benefited people's lives, and the ways in which now it's really the nerds and the geeks who are in a lot of ways leading the most exciting developments and the most innovative projects in the world, that's a kind of a paradigm shift in a lot of ways, especially in terms of our cultural views of things. You look now, even in theaters now, the two biggest films that this season or films about Stephen Hawking and
Interstellar?
No, Interstellar
is because Interstellar.
Thinking also
was great.
Of the Imitation Game of Turing, Alan Turing.
Oh, that's so amazing.
And you have these, you know, big stars playing these characters and really portraying, you know, how important that's been, rather than, you know, big military heroes, political heroes. Now it's people.
Oh, wait, political heroes? Does that exist?
It's a bit of an oxymoron, right?
Okay, just making sure. Absolutely. Keep going.
Yeah.
You're on a roll. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. I think that's really what I'm most excited about, seeing the kind of the brain drain away from centralized institutions and ideas toward these decentralized things, like in charity. Sean's Outpost, it's a great example of they are taking steps to disintermediate charity itself, nonprofits themselves. That's kind of one that's maybe there's less attention devoted toward because, I guess, maybe assumed a slightly different operations model, but that certainly can benefit from decentralization in a lot of ways,
yeah.
while still benefiting from great individuals like Jason King.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really kind of interesting. I wonder if we speak from a sort of skewed perspective, right?
Absolutely we do.
Do you
we
think
know.
So?
We know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Like,
there's
we,
no
we
question.
We talk about – okay. So two really interesting movies that I absolutely I haven't seen yet, but I will be going to see absolutely in person to show my commercial support for whatever was involved in the process is the Alan Turing movie and the Stephen Hawking movie. These are amazing films. These are two people who have contributed to society in ways that I still don't think – I don't think it's even possible for anyone today to be able to understand what level of contributions these individuals have provided, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not even at that point yet. So I'll be going to see this thing, but I wonder if we speak from a skewed perspective in that, you know, we live this, we breathe this every single day. Right, so we sort of hold a higher value to these, maybe these individuals, and ultimately these films. And I wonder if what does the average person think about these advancements? I know also that there can be a skewed perspective as a result of us being in the United States versus any other country in the world. Right, we have sort of a natural sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
We have a huge ego. But simultaneously, we also have one of the more detrimental education systems, the more detrimental government systems that results in, you know, lower intelligence and lower thinking in terms of philosophy.
That. I'd argue that. Have you seen some world governments?
So if you take a look at, you know, some of these other governments such as Korea and Japan, how they're teaching their children, or even Sweden, for example, even some of the EU countries, and how they're teaching their children and what their competency scores are and what they're bringing to the table in direct competition with American individuals. And you'll notice that the American population ultimately is vastly underperforming in terms of global scale.
Yeah.
Right? So I wonder if in combination with the national perspective, but also, you know, us personally, and we're talking about decentralization and this technology, if we have a skewed perspective, what is it? What does it take for individuals to look at this this space and understand the value of it? And what do they think? Right?
I can't speak on behalf of anyone there, but I could tell you what it would take. And that it comes down to the one point I've hammered home routinely pretty much in every episode, and it's access to quality factual information. When people hear about Bitcoin, for example, you know, for the first time, now I'm talking about people with very little technical expertise. Even if they do have some technical expertise, they kind of all fall in that because we're a part of the what, 1-3% that know about this kind of stuff. And the rest don't. And to them, it's either scary because it's challenging everything they ever knew about the financial system, everything they learned about money, albeit if they learned what was factual or what was taught in a textbook that maybe has an agenda behind it. I'm not there to dispute that. I'm just trying to say that's what their mindset is coming into this. And when, you know, you challenge that, and when you challenge people that really feel that, you know, we need the government to do this because we need the banks to do this because we need, you know, we need to help the poor. Well, I agree completely. We need to help the poor. Now, what's the best way to do that? That's where the issue happens, and that's where people see things like Bitcoin, and they get scared away because, you know, some people are using it for illicit purposes. You know, it's great to be able to show Sean's Outpost and say, well, people are also using it for good purposes, and the way it can help is in 5 or 10 years when this becomes more used, people will be able to do this, or people will be able to control their financial prosperity and not have to worry about maintaining a minimum balance, or a bank will close their account and take what little money they have. There are so many advantages to what's to come because of these technologies. That's what I love to preach on, because as soon as I start talking about backing money, backing gold, and you know, or backing, you know, anything like that, or economic theory, you lose people. Most people don't care. And yeah, that is a problem. But you can't just make them care in a minute or two. But what you can do is say, here's why I'm a part of this system and it's better, versus here's why your system stinks. And it's tough. It's a hard sell. And it's I think it's a slow process. It's much like the internet and how it became used. So I would say, yes, it's skewed. And you know, our viewpoint's definitely skewed there. And it's up to, you know, the people listening to this. Because if you're listening to this, you have an interest. Or if you're a part of this, you have an interest. And it's about reaching out to the people that maybe don't care and not getting too preachy, but in the same token saying, here's why I think it's cool, here's why I think it's neat, and then, you know, letting them make up their mind about it. Don't be too full of pressure. That's what my beliefs are and what I try to do.
And I think you've hit on a perfect point in answer to Eric's question, actually. And I think Eric had a great point that we may be skewed somewhat, that we understand these ideas on a conceptual level really well. But I think almost that the success of decentralization may not be in explicit knowledge of the vast majority of the population. My friend Isaac Morehouse, who founded Praxis, actually has this great theory of the spread of ideas and knowledge in society, that it's the academics, secondhand dealers in ideas, so to speak, who talk about conceptual and very advanced topics, they're definitely a part of introducing new concepts into society, but it's those who create experiences. The experience of decentralization, the experience of using Bitcoin, that's the most powerful thing for people, and even more powerful even than just the content of ideas. So telling a person about cryptography and the protections of Bitcoin can convince some people, but showing them a transaction, letting them have that feeling and that kind of rush, and seeing people's eyes light up, because I've seen this, that is so powerful. And I think that's almost a more important way of spreading these things. So in that sense, I do think decentralization is making strides forward.
Excellent. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Multigateway, which is the first decentralized crypto exchange, which is really interesting. And I don't necessarily know that it's the first, but it is claiming to be. Does anyone know anything about the technicals of Multigateway and, you know, why this is important and what it's actually attempting to do? Tony, do you have any information on this?
No, because it's funny. I was interested in it, and you were the person that I was going to ask for the technicals on it, because, you know, I think as far as the people that are speaking on this podcast, you have the best background. I don't want to say best. The most experience, you know, from the development-centric view of things like this. That's the best way I can phrase this. So what do you know, and how would you explain it to folks like me who don't have that background?
Historically, okay, Bitcoin is a decentralized currency. It's a decentralized ledger, distributed ledger that allows you to keep track of assets. There's a number of other altcoins that have been created on top of it, on top of similar blockchain technology. And what this sort of multi-gateway thing is getting at, I think, is this concept that why do we need a centralized clearinghouse to trade between one asset or another? OpenBazaar is, of course, approaching the same thing. A number of other people have tried to solve the same problem. We see this, look back historically, and you see like a number of exchanges cropping up. With the traditional markets, you have, you know, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. You have the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones, and all of these other exchanges that allow you to exchange traditional assets. With this new crypto asset, we have a number of exchanges cropping up, like Kraken and Bitstamp, and Mt. Gox was among them, and a number of exchanges, right? These are centralized parties that are run by an individual person who has to manage, you know, the technology, the order books. They have to manage making sure that their service is available. They have to manage, make sure that they have sufficient volume and liquidity to service the orders that are coming in over the markets. That is, in fact, the problem. The problem is that there must be a centralized entity to control these things. You can see the evidence of this problem manifesting itself in the form of exchanges going under, such as Camp BX, such as Mt. Gox, individual scammers. Anytime you have a centralized entity aggregating power, you have the opportunity for theft, you have the opportunity for fraud, and you have the opportunity for misleading the consumers of that centralized service. So Multi-Gateway is attempting to solve this problem by eliminating or disintermediating the third party, by making sure that there is a technological solution for exchanging value between one currency and another currency, and moreover, one asset and another asset, whether it be a currency or not. And it seems like it's based on the NXT decentralized asset exchange, which is an interesting technological solution, but I don't necessarily know that it's the same. It's the right solution. I think the markets will tell.
I think that's true for all of this. I haven't heard that many positive things about NXT, so I don't want to even make any statement on it. But I think when you go back 5 minutes ago about who controls it, when you say that there's one person that's controlling this, hence centralization, that also means that there's one person that can be corrupted, that can corrupt the entire system. And you're right. This idea of a decentralized exchange, I mean, it's inevitable, but it's also something where, you know, I would like to bring that inevitability as closer to now as we can. And I don't think that's the only thing that's holding this back. I think when I say holding it back, it's a weird term to use, but what's stopping Bitcoin from being more ubiquitous is the fact that it's more difficult to exchange what's currently used as currency to Bitcoin. And there needs to be that step, right? We need to be able to, much like the phone system that was, you know, installed decades before the internet. That's how the internet was often introduced to people, was via a dial-up phone modem. You need to be able to really make that step and make this usable to people in as easy way as possible. And I think that's the other key ingredient, if you will, that is going to be responsible for the popularity of things like this. It's not just decentralization, but it's the development of a technology that makes decentralization easier for the general public.
So Ripple and more recently Stellar are attempting to attack this space. What have you guys seen about in terms of Ripple and Stellar's development and adoption? Where do you guys see those things going?
Not far. I think that everyone that I've spoken with that knows more about this than I do, they're not very optimistic about the future of them. I always get the comment, they seem like good projects and they're good experiments, but you know, they don't have the long term promise that a Bitcoin does.
Yeah.
And that's what I really hear from that. And it's interesting though, because I do think they're important sidesteps and things that the Bitcoin protocol can really be improved upon in the future by studying things like that. And this is just for all coins, not just for Ripple and Stellar, which I've never had the ability to use. And I think what James mentioned earlier about being able to use them is really an important key, because I would feel a lot more confident speaking on these topics if I had used it. And the fact that I haven't used it has made it a little more difficult. But the fact also is that those who have used it aren't raving about it like you hear them raving about Bitcoin. That does leave a perception in my mind. I don't know exactly. How would you feel about those, both of those? Eric's shaking his head. Very interesting. I love it. So I think that the fact that, you know, we don't have a huge comment on it right now is because, you know, there's not as much information out there about it. And that, you know, to someone who's a complete newbie, where do they jump in? With Bitcoin, the resources are there, right? The resources are there for someone to jump in. And in order for any of these alternative payment systems like Ripple, like Stellar, and I do consider them, you know, completely different from the other altcoins out there, there really needs to be a good introduction, right? a place for introduction. And, you know, I think that's very, very important. I would also want to, you know, go into further detail about the decentralized exchange idea. How far away do you think that is from being a practical way for, you know, Joe Schmo to be able to get money out of his bank or credit card and buy Bitcoin?
I think we're a few years for sure.
Yeah.
I think the key here is getting the right technological solution. So Ripple attempted to solve this problem, but they didn't solve it in a truly decentralized way. Stellar tried to solve this problem, but they removed some of the centralized elements, but they didn't completely eliminate them. Again, it's not a complete solution. In the same way that Bitcoin was not the first cryptocurrency, however, it was the first one to provide a complete solution to the decentralization problem.
Right. And if I'm right, isn't Ripple partially centralized?
It is.
I don't know the specifics, but from what I understand,
Ripple and Stellar are both centralized in some of their aspects.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that, you know, let's say Skype is centralized with their supernodes, increasingly so than now that Microsoft has purchased them. There's a number of things here that in order for decentralized exchange to truly become possible, you have to have a truly underlying, technically complete solution. And I don't think that has necessarily emerged yet. There's some really interesting possibilities that have emerged as a result of the blockchain, but I think there will be another significant advance necessary for us to deliver true decentralized exchange. So the technologies that we can do today are a little bit inconvenient at best, which is such as double deposit, where, you know, if we're going to trade assets, we lock into the blockchain the value of what we're willing to exchange, meaning we're willing to say, if I'm going to defraud you, I'm going to have to give up this equal value back to you. If I defraud you and we both fail to meet our agreement. So I don't think that that is necessarily good enough because that requires a significant amount of capital lockup. I think there will be a technically complete solution that allows us to eliminate that value lockup and simultaneously have a trustless, decentralized solution for exchange. I don't think that that is going to emerge within the next year or two. I do think that 3, 5, 7 years from now, I think we will get there.
Absolutely. And I think it's something where along with all development around Bitcoin as a protocol, you're going to see as it has over the past 2 years, it's going to continue to get easier. It's going to continue to become more decentralized, and it's just going to continue to grow. And that's, you know, why we're doing this podcast is to grow and to get as many people out there that are interested in this as possible.
Today we have Sam Patterson from Open Bazaar, which is an open marketplace for being able to establish free trade using decentralized technology. Sam, why don't you give us a little bit of introduction as to who you are and why you're interested in Open Bazaar?
Great, and thanks for having me on the show. So I'm the operations lead for the Open Bazaar project, which has been around since April. It's an open source project to create a decentralized marketplace online, really a peer-to-peer marketplace. And the reason that I'm so interested in doing this, why I joined the project, and why I think we're starting to get some momentum and some support from the Bitcoin community is because right now, centralized marketplaces are more or less the only way you can do trade online. The eBays and the Amazons of the world are private companies who host their own servers that allow buyers and sellers to connect. They usually take a cut to do that, and you don't have much freedom over your own trade. So what we're doing is basically creating the architecture to allow folks to run a program on their computer locally and connect to other people doing the same thing and trade directly with them using Bitcoin. So we're really excited that this is going to open a lot of doors for Bitcoin users.
Absolutely. Just as a quick follow-up to that, is Bitcoin going to be the only currency that you're using on the store?
So right now, our focus is solely on Bitcoin and Open Bazaar. And the reason why is, I think, somewhat obvious, right? Bitcoin is the main, you know, cryptocurrency actually being used out there. And so we want to give the Bitcoin community something right off the bat. But what we have said when altcoins approach us to integrate it into the platform is, you know, A, this is open source. So anyone who wants to plug their altcoin into this can feel free to either fork the code and create their own project that uses their own altcoin, or what we prefer is submit a pull request to our repository. You know, give us the code to integrate your coin, and if it makes sense, if it works, then we'll do that. So just because Bitcoin is the leader, we're focusing on that right now, but we are okay with it being used with altcoins down the road.
Excellent. So talk to me a little bit about what open source means to you guys. Why is that such an essential component for what OpenBazaar is doing?
I think if you, I mean, this is part of a sort of a bigger discussion. It's not just about OpenBazaar, of course, but we want to give something to not just the Bitcoin community, but to everyone that wants to engage in trade online. We want to give them a tool that they are going to be able to use however they wish, you know, make changes, modifications, however they want, and be able to plug this tool into other existing platforms they already use and engage in trade however they want. So you just can't really do that with proprietary code, right? You don't know how it works. You can't really fiddle with it. So just like Bitcoin is open source, that allows it to be very flexible, allows people to use it just about however they want without any licensing restrictions and whatnot. We view OpenBazaar the same way. And specifically the way it's actually licensed, we chose the MIT license, which is the same that Bitcoin uses, because things like GPL require, if anyone makes changes to the code, to resubmit those changes to the rest of the community. And there's some reasons to think that might be a good thing, but we intentionally chose MIT because we want people to be able to use it however they want, no restrictions at all, and we're hoping that that grows this OpenBazaar network of users much more quickly than a more restrictive license.
Sam, can you tell us more about the participation and response you've received from the Bitcoin community and from the wider press and wider public?
Yeah, so some of it's been really positive, and overall we're excited about how many people are interested in the platform and who want to use the platform. We get emails just about every day from people who are currently on, you know, eBay or Etsy or Amazon, and they just can't wait to switch over once this thing's built. So that's been very positive. The media side of it has been a little bit sensational, which is not surprising. But, you know, a lot of these sort of dark net markets, and they're sort of combining us together with that, which is not true. You know, we're a very different project altogether. But we're still heartened by the fact that the community's been so supportive. So, you know, we forked back in April from Dark Market, which was a Toronto hackathon entry from Amir Taki and a couple of his friends. And we forked it, changed the name to OpenBazaar. This was Brian Hoffman, the project lead, who did this back in April. And I joined soon after. And it's just, we've had a slow, steady increase in the number of contributors on our GitHub, and sort of a core group of folks around the world have joined in. Now we have, gosh, I don't even know how many countries are involved. There's at least a half dozen different time zones that we have to coordinate with every time we try to have a developers meeting. But the response has been very positive. And where we're at right now is actually in beta 3. So we launched the initial open beta at the end of August. And then about every month, between a month and every 6 weeks, we launch a new beta. We're in beta 3 now, and hopefully in a couple weeks we'll have beta 3.1 and then beta 4 come out. So there's still a lot of work to be done. It's not ready for real, genuine trade yet, although there has been some actual transactions on the network. I bought some honey from a beekeeper in Ohio from it, and other people have bought stuff from Australia and around the world, but we're hoping that by next spring, that's actually going to be a point where the average Bitcoin user can easily get it going, get it installed, and start buying stuff from, you know, anywhere in the world without any fees or any restrictions.
Sam, let's back up just a second. Let's talk about what is the core problem that OpenBazaar is solving.
So I would say that there's a couple things that it's solving, but in terms of just the most practical reasons the average e-commerce user is going to see is the lack of fees. So right now, if you're a seller on eBay and you're using PayPal, the fees can be up to around 10% between eBay's cut and PayPal's cut. So what you're effectively doing is you're paying for the service of connecting, you know, the buyer and the seller together, and you're paying for some other things, maybe like buyer protection and whatnot. Well, the seller's not, but and what OpenBazaar allows is, you know, part of the reason that eBay and these other people have to charge this is because they have to own and operate servers and infrastructure and people to maintain all that infrastructure to allow people to connect, right? You're actually going right to their servers. OpenBazaar allows you, it allows everyone to utilize the infrastructure that already exists, your personal computers, your own internet, right? All that infrastructure is already out there. You don't need any new infrastructure to run this. It allows those people to connect to each other. So the server and all the people required to maintain the server are cut out, and all the costs associated are no longer borne by the buyer and the seller. So it's just cheaper. It's effectively, there's no cost for the buyer and seller to engage and trade with each other. So lack of fees is probably the biggest thing that most people will see off the bat. More control over your own trade is really the next one. So for a whole lot of different reasons, you know, you may not be that satisfied with the restrictions that are in place on existing platforms, right? They're completely controlled by third parties. So one, for example, I have just moved away from DC, and Brian Hoffman is the project lead, is also lives in DC. And right now, Etsy, I think maybe a month or two ago, Etsy announced that they weren't going to allow the buying or selling of any Washington Redskins NFL team products on their platform, because they claim this is discrimination. And that's fine. That private company, if they want to prevent people from, you know, selling goods on their service, that's great. They can do that. But naturally, if you're using those platforms, you're very limited by those choices they make. So with OpenBazaar, it's really between the buyer and the seller to agree how they're going to engage in trade, and no one else can enforce rules on them. So lack of fees and control over your own trade are probably the two biggest problems that OpenBazaar is solving.
Yeah, very, and I think it's an awesome idea, and you know, it's an idea that you could tell the roots were born in other services that are available. And I think that, you know, in order to come to an awesome idea like this, usually you get inspired by using some other similar, not necessarily similar, but some product or service that is related in some way. And it seems like when we're having these conversations with different entrepreneurs, you know, venture capitalists, just people that are in this scene, it usually comes back to Bitcoin. It usually comes back to BitTorrent to some degree, way less than Bitcoin. And just, you know, the ability to control your own, to control what you can, and to control your own commerce, to control what you trade, who you do business with. And, you know, I know you went into a little bit of detail earlier about OpenBazaar, but we always like to ask, just in general, to see where this comes from. What got you interested in Bitcoin? And for that matter, when did that light bulb go off? Because it happens with everyone, you know. Some people sooner than others, but eventually people come around and usually they're converted.
So my story is very similar to many in the community, which is, this is probably mid-2012 or so. Well, maybe early 2012. I had some friends. You know, I was already sort of a libertarian. I was involved in that ideological movement, and they kept telling me about, you know, Bitcoin and how valuable it was. And I was more of a precious metals, you know, sort of guy, and disregarded it for months. Finally, I had some, basically just reached a tipping point where there's a couple of people that I really respected, you know, kept harping on me. So I dove into it. Actually, when they first started talking about it, I did download the blockchain and looked into it, and you know, I just didn't seem like it made sense to me, so I deleted it. I didn't mind any, you know, I don't have any regret stories about that, you know. But I eventually got back into it and started really diving into the details. And just like everyone else, once you start going down that rabbit hole and you start realizing the problems that this solves, you know, I was hooked. What I actually found was, in doing the research into Bitcoin, there was no single introductory you know, book, especially just a short ebook on the subject, which I thought was kind of a gap. So I actually wrote one of the first ebook guides to as an introduction to Bitcoin in early 2013. And it's still on Amazon, Bitcoin Beginner, it's called, and it became the bestseller on Bitcoin on Amazon, actually, for quite some time. I don't recommend folks go buy it now because it's completely outdated. It's a year and a half old, which in the Bitcoin space is, you know, ancient. So, but that sort of opened some doors because I became, I guess, the lead seller on Amazon on the subject of Bitcoin. So I got to go to some conferences in the libertarian space because I already had worked in the libertarian space for a while and talk about Bitcoin. And I was approached by a book publisher to write a second book about Bitcoin. And by that point, I felt, you know, I'm not so big on IP. And I thought my next book, instead of going that route, maybe I'll just crowdfund it up front and then release the book for free. So I was looking for topics to tackle that I thought the community would be interested in. And that's when I saw Amir Taki's Dark Market at the Toronto Hackathon. And I thought, you know what? Decentralized markets are going to be a powerful idea. Like, they're going to change the world in a very positive way if they get created. And so after, you know, Amir Taki wasn't continuing the development of Dark Market, but Brian Hoffman took it up. It just so happened he lived very close by to where I lived. So I asked him if I could do an interview with him because I wanted to get a book started about the decentralized market movement, and I wanted to be in the ground floor right when this guy started building it. I wanted to interview him. But after interviewing him for like an hour, his vision was so compelling for, you know, how this could really be beneficial that I decided, instead of writing the book, I'm just going to join the project and try to make it happen myself.
So you're really talking about a few interesting people here with a lot of interesting ideas. Talk to us a little bit about maybe some more role models, some people who are really standing out to you as thought leaders in the current decentralization space.
That's a really good question. Well,
you know what? Let me make an addendum, too. You can name companies as well, because I know some of the most exciting things that are happening. I have no idea if I can name names behind them.
Yeah. So I've already mentioned a couple. I mean, Brian Hoffman, I have a lot of respect for him taking on the Open Bazaar project, and I think he's done a great job for the past 7 months or so to get it going. Amir Taki, of course, you know, came up with the original idea for this, and he's done an amazing job on other projects as well. Other decentralization aspects of the movement. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to actually think about it. There are a lot of people. Well, you guys probably know better than I do. I mean, there's a lot of people in this space trying to do some really exciting stuff. I mean, I know the groups, you know, Storage and MadeSafe, and everyone trying to do decentralized storage and decentralized internet is really exciting. The MeshNet stuff that's going on in Seattle and elsewhere, I have a very high hopes for. So my day job is actually a tech policy analyst. So I read and write a lot about technology policy and everyone griping about net neutrality and about internet regulations. And what I think people are overlooking is we have another check and balance on ISPs becoming too powerful, which is just creating an alternative internet through mesh networking. So I have a lot of hope that in the future, you know, that is going to be sort of the ultimate decentralization that allows us to build all these other platforms on. So if we have decentralized communication of the internet, decentralized money with Bitcoin and then decentralized trade with platforms like Open Bazaar, really, by that point, I think we've won. You know, the genie's out of the bottle, and we're going to have the power to make the world a much freer place than it is now.
Yeah, so you talk a lot about the movement and this ideologue of decentralization versus centralization. What is the movement, right? If you were going to describe this to an outside party, what is this movement and why is it so important?
So I would call it disintermediation. And all that means is the removal of intermediaries. So when you look throughout history, and I don't want to go dive too deeply into the theory here. Other people have done this more compelling than I could. There's actually one scholar that I'd recommend, Eli Dorado at the Mercatus Center. He has written about disintermediation in the past and done a good job on that. Is basically there were always gatekeepers. There were always individuals who have special access to knowledge or control in society. And the history of sort of the modernization, the civilization of the modern world is technological, I would say primarily technological advancements that take power away from them and spread it down to more of the masses. So, right, the printing press is, of course, one of the earliest and best examples of this. Instead of having a very select number of people who controlled scientific and religious knowledge at the time, what the printing press allowed is for that to be distributed, you know, much more widely. And then, of course, the internet is probably the ultimate example of this disintermediation. You know, before the internet, and this is, you know, not so long ago, many people remember this period, knowledge was primarily distributed through television, through newspapers, through books at the library, or through word of mouth. And it was primarily one way, except for word of mouth, it was primarily one way. So unless you worked in a television station, or you wrote a book, or you worked in a newspaper, you didn't really have the opportunity to communicate your thoughts and ideas with anyone that wasn't physically located near you. So of course the internet now has taken out all those intermediaries, and you can communicate with anyone around the world effectively for free. And of course, Bitcoin is now disintermediating the financial industry. And what we hope is that Open Bazaar is going to disintermediate the e-commerce industry. So those handful of big companies, eBay, Amazon, who control these servers that everyone uses, that take a cut, you know, we hope to just wipe them out, take that middleman out entirely. So I view it as a move to disintermediate a lot of these powerful gatekeepers in society and really bring control down to the individual level as much as possible.
Excellent, excellent. So what do you think is actually the next step for Open Bazaar? What are the things that you're thinking about now for the next 6 months and then maybe even the next 2 years?
Yeah, those are actually good timelines, 6 months and 2 years. So 6 months is getting it to a full release. And that's probably about, I think, when we're going to have it is mid to late spring next year, is get it to a full release. And what we mean by full release is a platform that is as easy to use as existing e-commerce platforms. So someone can switch from an eBay, an Amazon, an Etsy over to Open Bazaar without much hassle at all. That's our goal. And it's a pretty big goal, you know, for us to be doing this. We're a nonprofit. We're not doing this for money. We're all volunteer. None of us are full-time. So to do that in less than a year, right, from April to, well, who knows, maybe about a year, would be, a pretty difficult task. But we're on track, I think, to do that. So that's the next 6 months. The next 2 years, I mean, I really view this as the full release is the start. Like once we get the full release, that's when we actually start this movement for online open free trade, which is really how I view Open Bazaar as being. It's not just an open source protocol for online trade. It's more like a movement for free trade online. And that's when it begins, is after that 6 months. So over the next, couple years after that is out, I expect a lot of what we're going to be doing is, first of all, improving the platform. You can't just release something and expect it's perfect, which it certainly will not be. There's a lot of improvements that will need to be made, a lot of features people want added, so we'll continue doing that. But then also responding to mischaracterizations about what we're trying to do is going to be a big part of it. We are meant to be the next evolution in online trade, right? We're taking it from centralized to decentralized, and people are going to maybe look more at the negative aspects of that than the positive ones. And so we're going to try to be there along the way to point out just how powerful and how positive this technological advancement can be for people.
One of the great features of decentralized technology, it seems, is its participatory nature. How can people support OpenBazaar and be a part of this project?
Well, I appreciate you asking. There's a few ways that we can do it. The biggest one is if you are a developer, we would love to have your, at the very least, to have your eyes on the code, but also to contribute, to make bug fixes, to add features, but just to get in there and take a look at it and ask us good questions, and that's immensely helpful. We have about 10 to 15 core people who are really devoted and doing good work on it, but they're all volunteer, and so we can always use more help. If you're not a developer, there's a few ways you can help. One is just spreading the word, so that for one, other developers see it, right? We want more developers, but also so that once this platform is usable, people are already aware of it and already know what we're trying to do, and then all it is for them is to just download it and try to run it instead of explaining it to them, so that they're already aware of it. Also, just helping out in sort of the media and highlighting the positive use cases for it is always helpful. And lastly, donations. Now, I want to be clear, we aren't, because we're all volunteer, no one has this as a full-time job. If we don't get donations, we're still going to keep going. So we're not really pushing hard for this. But if we want to scale this up to the point where it really can start to compete with, major e-commerce platforms, at some point we're going to need more resources and more dedicated, staff and whatnot. So we'll need crowdfunding. If you go to openbazaar.org, or if you go to our OpenBazaar subreddit on Reddit, you can find a lot more information about what we're trying to do and ways that you can donate or contribute otherwise to the project.
Awesome. And in addition to that, before we let you go, we wanted to give you a chance to plug your personal Twitter, any personal information you'd want to give out to people that may want to contact you about OpenBazaar or anything, any other projects that are similar, any ways that the community can contact you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So my Twitter is at Samuel Patt, P-A-T-T. I'm not that active on Twitter, though, so if you're looking to contact me, a better way, if you're contacting me about OpenBazaar, it's sam@openbazaar.org. Or if you're contacting me just about Bitcoin or anything in general, you can email me at bitcoin@samuelrpatterson.com. And that website, samuelrpatterson.com, is my personal website. It has other links to contact me or to look at other projects I'm working on.
So when can we switch from email to BitMessage?
Well, I do use BitMessage. It's a little clunky to give up my my ID.
Exactly.
I don't know. It's a great question. And we actually do integrate BitMessage into the OpenBazaar platform. And the hope is for us to integrate Namecoin so that using the identities is going to be a lot easier. But that's still a feature that we've yet to add.
Yeah, I think Web of Trust and Proof of Identity are maybe the next big problems to solve to make both OpenBazaar and Bitcoin successful.
I agree, and those are not trivial to solve. I mean, we are trying to build a Web of Trust for the Reputation Network with OpenBazaar, and it's hard to do. So hopefully that's something that we and other teams figure out, and I agree, that can be very powerful.
Excellent. Well, Sam Patterson, thank you very much for joining us.
With that being said, I think we're about to wrap up, and I wanted to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Hopefully y'all enjoy football and turkey, if that's your thing. Football's mine, turkey's not. Don't be a jive turkey, and I would like
soccer season's coming to a close. What are you talking about?
Oh, no. What am I to do? I'm not much of a soccer fan, sorry. Sting is back in the WWE, and by back, I mean for the first time ever, so yeah, 21 years. We can talk about that. With all that being said, I wanted to say farewell from the Decentralized crew until next week, and happy Thanksgiving.
And this is Decentralized. We'll be right back.